from KQED.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Climate change has put more than 25 million acres of California wildlands under very high or extreme threat of fire. That's according to a report released Friday by Governor Newsom's office. And the report includes a sweeping set of wildfire prevention recommendations, including the radical restructuring of PG&E, which faces more than $30 billion in potential wildfire liabilities. We're going to discuss the proposals, and we're going to get the latest on PG&E's recent leadership overhaul and its Chapter 11 reorganizations. And let me tell you who is joining us. Marisa Lagos is here with us in studio, politics correspondent with KQED, co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast. Good morning, Marisa.
Morning, Michael.
We'll also say good morning to Stephen Weissman, who joins us, emeritus lecturer at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, former director of the Berkeley Law Energy Program, and he's also former administrative law judge for the CPUC, the California Public Utilities Commission, and a policy and legal advisor to three PUC commissioners. Welcome, Stephen Weissman.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let me begin with you, Marisa. This report that's come out is kind of a roadmap, really, from Governor Newsom to protect the utilities, really, some are saying, and I think that at least from costs where wildfires are concerned. But there's a possible path here in terms of that protection. Let's outline it for listeners.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's important to know, first off, that Newsom was very careful not to specifically endorse any one plan. His office is framing this as a menu of options for lawmakers to sort of consider as they move forward, with both the short-term concerns of stabilizing the utilities, not just PG&E. The other two big investor-owned utilities have seen some real sort of threats from Wall Street around their ability to borrow capital. And
Southern California Edison and San Diego.
And San Diego Gas and Electric, that's right. And then there's the sort of longer-term concerns, obviously. How do we not have a repeat of the past 2 years every fire season? And so I would say, you know, it's a 58-page report. There's a lot in there. Beyond the sort of, I hate to say it, but obvious things around, you know, forest maintenance and sort of preventative measures, I think the biggest ticket items are three different proposals for potentially stabilizing the utilities. Two of them are some sort of insurance fund that utilities and possibly other parties would pay into that would essentially act as a backstop if a catastrophic fire occurred. Another is to change that much debated liability law in California called inverse condemnation, which essentially says that these utilities are responsible for any damage, even if they acted responsibly. So,
but forgive me, to change that, it's going to have to be state constitutional change. Right?
Right. And so the governor did lay out that they basically feel like the path to that is to go to the state Supreme Court, petition the state Supreme Court, and ask them if they will consider kind of reinterpreting the law, because the way that the Constitution has been interpreted by the courts is a big part of this. And that if the courts sort of agreed with a different reading of that law, that possibly it could be changed through the state legislature. Now, that's not to say there's any appetite to change that law in the state legislature, but it is interesting that Newsom at least put it on the table as a topic.
There's so much that depends on the state legislators' response of the legislators to what he's put on the table here. But he's also put on the table even the possibility of breaking up PG&E into smaller government agencies.
Yeah, I mean, they essentially say that no option should be off the table, including potentially making PG&E a set of smaller utilities, a government takeover. I mean, I do think that one of the challenges with those proposals, which I haven't seen anybody really seriously put forward any details around, is that, you know, arguably the aging infrastructure is the biggest problem. And so if the state were to sort of acquire the company, they would acquire that mess themselves. And then there's an entire section on PG&E. They did not pull any punches, I'll say. And they really...
They took them to the woodshed, basically.
Yeah, they said that, you know, something that I've heard lawmakers say, which is that the utility's decision to voluntarily file for Chapter 11 reorganization under the bankruptcy code, and this is a quote, punctuates more than two decades of mismanagement, misconduct, and failed efforts to improve its safety culture. And so I do think that, you know, Newsom is trying to sort of walk a fine line here between what his office and lawmakers really see as a sort of untenable option, which is these utilities failing, which, you know, I do think it's important to note, and our other guest, Steve Weissman, can talk about this in depth. But, you know, ratepayers lose out no matter what. Like, there is not a situation here where PG&E can just get punished, and those of us paying our electricity bills don't see an impact on, you know, what those bills look like. But I also think that, you know, from a political perspective, Newsom is really striking a very different posture than his predecessor. He knows that this is something he's going to be judged on. And as someone who's watched Newsom since he was mayor, I was interested. I feel like on a personal level, like he's pretty mad at PG&E. And there's always been a lot of feeling in San Francisco that folks like Newsom were very close with the utility. This is their hometown here. You know, he's the former mayor. But I think that he is, you know, when he was mayor, we saw some of their underground equipment explode. That, of course, predated San Bruno, where people died when their neighborhood blew up from a gas line explosion. And then you go into the fires of recent years. So that's all to say, I don't think there's a ton of love lost for this utility right now. And I think that Newsom is going to go as far as he can to hold them accountable. But I think what that looks like, again, is an open question.
Well, and you were mentioning the governor's language, and the language was very curious to me when he talked about the fact that they won't, and I'm quoting here, misdirect, mislead, or manipulate the people of California. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds pretty hopeful, particularly when you think about the fact that there was a meeting of the CPUC just yesterday during which the commissioners expressed skepticism about PG&E's new board and its ability to implement safety programs.
Yeah, and I mean, before those board members were actually publicly announced, Newsom took the unusual step of sending a letter he made public, essentially blasting their first slate of directors. I know that they changed a couple names. I think there's a lot of questions in California about both these 10 new directors and the new head, Bill Johnson, who's coming from the Tennessee Valley Authority, who I think has a lot of success in his past of cutting costs and bringing down debt, but has some questions around safety and other projects that he's overseen. And so, the CPUC had harsh questions. Lawmakers have had a lot of harsh questions. I think this is something where, in some ways, they have no control over it, right? This is a publicly traded company. It is not a state. You know, they're regulated by the state, but the state, in theory, doesn't have a lot of power over them. I think what you're seeing the governor and others, including the state regulators, the CPUC, look at is what power they can exercise in terms of when PG&E exits bankruptcy, because they will have to agree to any rate increases, the state will. And then I think sort of in the court of public opinion, there's a sense that, you know, pushing this company in a different direction is something that they're trying to do. And again, that, you know, potentially other options could be on the table if they don't like where they go. But it certainly, I think, speaks to the culture that we've seen repeatedly at PG&E, that they did sort of buck what the governor and lawmakers were expressing concerns about, and still put in a slate of directors that is largely representing Wall Street interest. And we can get into that. But I have
heard their stock is going up after it went up about 20% after Gavin Newsom gave this report out on Friday.
And it's not just that. It's that we've seen the stock, you know, which I think was around $40 last summer before the campfire, after the 2017 fires, plummeted it to $7 a share right before the bankruptcy, is back up to around 20. I haven't checked it today. But there's a sense on Wall Street, and let me say this, one thing that has come up a lot is how many Wall Street investors and bond agencies have flooded the state capital in recent weeks to make the case that stabilization of these utilities is necessary. It is a case that the governor and lawmakers seem to have heard. And I think that there is a sense on Wall Street that, which is true in some ways, that we need these companies to survive, to keep the lights on, and that they're probably going to come out looking pretty good at the end of this bankruptcy, which is sort of remarkable given they're in Chapter 11.
Well, and let me go to Stephen Wiseman on this, because the lobbyists are all over Sacramento on this, as Marisa just indicated, Stephen Wiseman. And can we talk first with you about the CPUC, since we've been alluding to it? There's been a lot of criticism that they're, in the past they've met too much behind closed doors and worked with lobbyists too much.
Well, I think there have been a number of issues, I think, that have made it a little bit of a challenge for the commission to maintain the level of credibility with the public that I think it ought to be able to do. First, as you mentioned, there has been a culture at the Public Utilities Commission for as long as I've known to entertain private meetings with parties that have an interest in the outcome of proceedings. And this is relatively of an outlier approach. Most economic regulatory agencies around the country don't allow for that kind of communication. But it does happen in California, and so the question is how do best make sure that the things that are said behind closed doors are reported out and people have a chance to contest them. But the challenges the commission has faced here also has a strong historical element to it, which is that the commission, I think, for many years really de-emphasized its work in terms of trying to protect the safety of utility infrastructure in the state. We saw that with the San Bruno accident. After that, I remember looking back at annual reports from the commission for a decade prior to that to see how often the commission was talking about pipeline safety. And it basically virtually never talked about pipeline safety. And the staffing, I think, in terms of the number of people who were placed in safety roles reflected that as well. Well, now you have much more of an emphasis on safety. In the governor's report, he talks about even ramping up the safety expertise even more. But I think that part of what the commission has been locked up in has been a sense probably across society for many years that government should not have a heavy hand in terms of overseeing and regulating the companies within its jurisdiction. And I think that in this instance, we've got a company that, despite often changing its management structure, despite different rules being put in place, and despite having as much as $1 billion disallowance imposed on the company after the San Bruno accident, still has had a history, even post-San Bruno, of falsifying pipeline safety records and doing other things to make safety less than the top priority. How do you get on top of that? And I think that part of that has to involve having much more close oversight, at least of this particular company, for the near future in order to ask critical questions about the way incentives are structured and the way that the utilities plan their resources. Do they have enough inspectors in place themselves? Do they have enough money put into improving infrastructure? This is going to require, I think, much closer management for this company going forward, regardless of what happens with the bankruptcy proceeding.
And you've pointed out that if that management is not scrutinizing carefully what's going on, the rates are going to skyrocket and it's going to become too risky with PG&E borrowing more and more, and the rates are really going to be, to some extent, not only much higher, but it's going to be much more of an effect on things like climate change and really the environmental concerns that many have. But you've gone kind of out on a limb in some ways, and I want to get your thoughts about this. To talk about undergrounding is a real plausible way or option to be thinking about the future, because most people say it's just too expensive and it can't be done. And you've kind of looked at the math and the numbers, and I think, I don't know if you're a strong advocate, but you're saying it's plausible, it can be done, maybe should be done.
Well, I think that the assumptions that have been underlying our willingness for the last 140 years at this point to just rely on 19th century technology and put poles in the ground and tack some wires to them, our decision to do this is based on the assumption that this is the least cost way to provide utility service. That's interesting in and of itself, because I don't think there are a lot of things in our collective efforts that we require to be the least cost approach all the time. We don't apply that to most of our decisions, but we do apply it here. And the assumption is proving to be not an accurate one, since it appears that this type of 19th century infrastructure carries with it a lot of potential liability. So if you assume, for instance, building a big new transmission line for $1 billion, that's all it's going to cost, that assumption may not pan out. If, in fact, you're going to have to spend several $1 billion to recover, to pay off liabilities related to fires that are triggered by that particular line. And so I think that I don't have specific numbers, specific proof yet, but I think that that what is clear is that we need to be more honest with ourselves when we look at the costs of one alternative versus another. Do we put lines above ground? Do we put them below ground? Do we try to avoid the need for more transmission lines by building more generation close to where the customers are? Do we rely more on distributed resources like rooftop solar? These are questions, I think, that may have different answers to them if we're honest with ourselves about the potential costs attached to the old poles and wires approach.
Well, the big question remains, and the toughest one, equitability of distribution where liability is concerned. But I want to invite you, our listeners, to join us and hear your thoughts about Governor Newsom's proposals and where they ought to go. And any questions you have, join us now at our toll-free number. You can do that by calling in at 866-733-6786. And we welcome your calls, your thoughts, your reactions, as well as your questions. And again, join the program at 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking about a new set of recommendations from the governor's office to prevent catastrophic fires with Marisa Lagos, politics correspondent with KQED and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast, and Stephen Weissman, emeritus lecturer at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and former director of Berkeley Law's Energy Program, also a former administrative law judge. And there's something in the report about administrative law judges. Let me actually go to you on this, Marisa, about not only streamlining regulatory proceedings and reforming. I just want to flesh this out a little more, but also actually changing the number of commissioners and delegating more to staff and law judges?
Yeah, I mean, there's long been a sense, I think, among critics of the PUC that there is things take way too long there and that there's sort of too much deliberation. And, you know, I think what Michael Picker, the president of the commission, would say is that's exactly how this commission was set up, that it is a sort of plodding regulatory process.
But Newsom's saying got to streamline.
Huh? And Newsom, yeah, and I think that there's been these sort of echoes of this for a while. And so, one of the things they're putting out there is the idea of basically shortening proceedings, putting less in front of commissioners, more in front of staff, less in front of administrative law judges. And I think that, you know, one thing that I think almost everybody would hope to see is one of the other ideas, which is to expand their budget. I think that, you know, if you look at the service territory of what they are charged with overseeing, and if you compare it to other states in which the regulators actually have far less on their plate, that California is really far behind. I think that one thing that we thought we might see more of in here and that lawmakers still may consider, which is kind of splitting up the CPUC itself and taking some things off of their plate. So, yes, they're looking at electrical and gas lines, but they're also responsible for overseeing Lyft and Uber and these transportation companies, even though they're not responsible for taxis. And so there's a lot of questions, I think, about the efficacy of the CPUC and whether their sort of core mission of safety can be realized when they have so many things that they're responsible for overseeing. And Professor Weissman did spend some time there, so he might have some thoughts on this.
Well, they're also talking about setting rates and improving enforcement, and the transmission costs came out in this report are artificially low, which many had assumed for quite some time. Professor Weissman, can I get you to opine here?
Yeah, well, in terms of the issue of trying to put more of the decision-making at the PUC on the staff level, I think that there's a suggestion in the report that it might be necessary to change the law to some extent to do that. I think that there's a lot that could be done now in terms of expanding on what's really been done for a long time, which is taking the experts on the staff and delegating to them the background work and the analysis necessary to make some of these perhaps more minor decisions, and then lining up that decision to be reviewed by administrative law judge and then passed on to the commission. The commission, when it meets every couple of weeks, they have a lot of things that are on consent agenda, meaning that they don't spend a lot of time reviewing them or have an open public debate about those subjects. And so there are tools that are already in place to try to move some of the more minor things largely off the plates of the commissioners and the administrative law judges. I think that going beyond that, to actually give final legal authority to the staff may be problematic because of the issues related to accountability and judicial review. But I think that there certainly is more room for tightening things up there in terms of trying to shorten proceedings.
Stephen Weissman, we've got a lot of callers on the line here. I want to get to as many as I can here, but I want to go back.
Oh, absolutely.
Just a quick question to you, though, if you could, because Marisa alluded to Michael Picker, who actually said at a commission meeting that The commissioners, he said a majority of the board appear to have little experience with building corporate safety programs. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's been a little early to scrutinize all of the new board members and be able to reach a conclusion on that. But I think I was struck by something that was said by a commenter at the commission's meeting yesterday who talked about the challenges in developing an effective safety culture at a large institution like this. And he said that there's no – he used the term there's no slam dunk way to reorganize the staff or to change the personnel that's going to automatically give us that better safety culture. And I think, again, there's going to have to be reliance on much closer monitoring and oversight by the state and by the Public Utilities Commission. That speaker also pointed out, for instance, that on the federal level, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has a resident inspector in each one of the commercial nuclear power plants who lives there, who works with the staff, has full access to all the information on site. With PG&E, we'd be talking about the need for much more than one person in residence. I'd certainly like to see the commission establish an office at PG&E's headquarters and have experts on site who can be asking hard questions all up and down the line.
I'm going to go to our callers now. First, let me read a comment by Lisa. Strong opinion. She writes, we need to stop years of PG&E abuse. Too much power for an inept, corrupt organization. A public utility monopoly must be accountable to the people, not the stock market. And here's our first caller. Jake, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call again. I've got first a question, then a comment regarding the bankruptcy. First, it's interesting that the old board of directors filed for a voluntary Chapter 11 to be immediately replaced by a new board of directors. I'm curious why that was not a decision made by the new board of directors, or at least that decision postponed until the new board of directors could weigh in. Secondly, my comment on that is that my wife actually works for PG&E in the division that handles tree clearing around lines and, you know, basically a wildfire response program. And she's noted that they've had an exceptionally hard time finding contractors that are willing to do this tree trimming work for them because of that Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So it seems like they kind of shot themselves in the foot on this bankruptcy by now making it more difficult to do the work they so desperately need to do.
Jake, thank you for that. Marisa?
Well, I share Jake's
shot in the foot
confusion and sort of bewilderment, let's say, at the opaque process of the oversight of this incredibly important, you know, agency. I mean, or business. Like, I have these same questions. Like, okay, wait, if the entire board or all but three members of a 13-member board are getting fired, and you have an interim CEO, who's actually making the call on these new board members? I think it's their interim CEO, John Simon, who is a longtime counsel, you know, lawyer for PG&E, is a sort of lifetimer there. But I think it is, you know, I think there's a lot of valid questions that he's bringing up that I have been asking as well. And the truth is, you know, I think this gets to some of the weirdness of the sort of pseudo public private relationship that the state finds itself in with an investor owned utility. There are so many decisions being made behind closed doors that the state really has no power over or hand in. There is so much that is riding on the way that Wall Street reacts to this in terms of shareholders, but also in terms of bond ratings and what the agencies decide in terms of how much these organizations can borrow money for. You know, I think it's I find it sort of – I have not, to my liking, gotten sort of sufficient answers to those questions yet, and I promise that I will continue asking them.
Well, you're dogged. We have a great deal of faith in your asking cool questions. And here's Thomas joining us from Novato. Thomas, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. So my point of view is possibly a little bit different now. I am not saying that PG&E shouldn't get their power lines in order and such. However, I think a lot of the issues is deferred maintenance on properties. So I am actually, I do work in the field, and I notice that there are many properties that are completely overgrown. We have what's, quote, called a plant or a fire safe list of plants, which is just kind of BS all plants are fire resistant as long as the properties are maintained properly. And I just think it's a little bit, how to put it, a little bit unfair to point all the finger at PG&E when there are many properties that people just don't maintain. There's so much undergrowth and brush and fire ladders and all this stuff that there's proof and examples of a maintained property being able to withstand fires much better than one that has so much undergrowth.
Sorry, Thomas, I think you make a reasonable point, and I thank you for it. I'm going to let it stand unless anybody wants to respond.
Well, I think he's right. I mean, and I think that if you read all 58 pages of the governor's report, he gets at that. This is a discussion we've been having. The truth is, take PG&E out of it. If I maintain my home, Michael, you don't, and we're next door to each other, you know, I don't live in a bubble, right? So those all make a difference. I think the question is, I mean, in the campfire, for example, the thought is and the belief is, and PG&E has said that they think this is probably what happened, that, you know, a 100-year-old huge tower that had not been properly maintained fell down and sparked that. So I think both are true, and I think that that's something that the state is grappling to get its arms around, which is the personal responsibility piece along with the sort of private companies and then, of course, what the state needs to do itself.
And I'm going to read a remark from Stephen Wiseman. Please go ahead. I was just going to read a remark, though, from Chris first. He says, we must remember PG&E is bound to a geography and service. Before lawmakers in the California PUC moved to change PG&E's corporate structure, its circumstance must be considered to avoid a similar problem with a different name. Utilities, even those privately owned, do not operate with full freedom. Sorry, go ahead, Professor Wiseman.
Oh, that's fine. I just wanted to say that I was gratified that the governor's report led with discussion about how to better manage the fire-prone lands. We're talking about reducing the intensity of wildfires, as the last caller was just discussing. And I think that ultimately, of course, we're not going to eliminate wildfires, even if the utilities can be perfect in their management of their system. We get thousands of wildfires a year, most of which are started by lightning and other things. What we need to do is have a centralized, top-down system of establishing standards for individual property owners, accountability, and then working with local governments and the federal government to make sure that comprehensively we're doing things across the state to reduce fire risk.
Well, we will continue to obviously follow and stay on top of this story. Marisa, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Stephen Wiseman, for joining us. Good to have you with us.
You're welcome.
And good to have you, our listeners. If you want to continue this discussion, go online to our website, kqed.org/forum. And Northstar said in a report the new safety plan PG&E developed fell short and that it continues to be concerned that the company's divisions are, well, adopting safety plans independent of each other. We'll talk more about PG&E, rest assured. Stay tuned for more here on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.